Open your lesson books, if you have them, and to lesson number 15, Using Your Zeal, and we will work our way through this lesson today. You can also open your Bibles to the book of Nehemiah, and we'll make a few references to Nehemiah. It's a book of 13 chapters, and there is a lot in it, and I'm hoping that you are familiar somewhat with the story of Nehemiah, and so we'll make reference to it, but we won't have time to go into all the details of this good story, but it is a great story. It's a wonderful story. It's a powerful story of Nehemiah and his zeal, as we've been talking about lessons on zeal. His zeal for the Lord, his zeal for his people, his zeal for rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem. And it is an excellent lesson as we talk about our lessons on zeal. And so we're talking now, we have said in our lessons that the several steps in building and maintaining our zeal. We're down to the fifth of 7 points that the author makes in the book, and that is using your zeal, using our zeal. And so if we have ignited our zeal and fueled our zeal and protected our zeal, we need now to use our zeal, to put it into use, to put it into practice. And so this lesson, there'll be two lessons, I believe, on using your zeal. And this lesson is on changing your corner of the world. What do you think the author means by changing your corner of the world? What would that phrase mean to us?
We can only influence where we are. Well, that's not entirely true, but for the most part, the influence you have where you are.
Yeah, yes, we can influence beyond where we are physically. Isn't that right? I mean, I think that's what you're referring to. We can influence where we are physically, and we can influence some other places physically. But you can only influence what you can influence. Your influence can be seen by your life. Let me give you an example. Sometimes when people have heard that I've traveled to China, they say, well, why China? I don't know. I guess because I met someone who was going to China, and I went with him, and I got excited about that and continued to go. They say, well, why not Bulgaria? Why not Russia? Why not somewhere else? Well, I can't be everywhere. I can't go. I just don't have the time. I don't have the hours to go everywhere. Lakeland and my work with China keeps me pretty busy, just those two places. We can only do so much. We can't be everywhere. But influence the corner where you are. Your corner may be, your peace may be in Lakeland, or it may be in your immediate where you live, or it may be with the people that you work in with. It may be, in my case, some opportunities to go to China, but even as I go to China, I can't go to all of China. I just have to go to certain places where I know people and influence a little bit where I am, just the corner where I am. So influence the corner, change the corner where you are. Influence the corner where you are, whether that is, whether physically or some other way. Influence who you can influence. And so I think that's the idea that the author is saying. Let your light shine. So in the introduction to our lesson today, he talks about in Matthew 5, you know the passage in 14 through 16, let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works, verse 16, and glorify your Father who is in heaven. And so, let your light shine. That's our influence. We need to let our light shine by our lives, by our words, by our deeds, by our love, by our caring about other people. So let your light shine before men so that you can get a lot of glory from men. Is that the reason? So people will pat you on the back and talk about what a nice person you are. No, that's not the motivation. In fact, it may just be the opposite. If you're serving God and living for Him, some people won't like it probably. But let your light shine, that they may see your good works, and hopefully it will bring glory to your Father who is in heaven. Look at Acts chapter 17. Here in Acts chapter 17 is the story of Paul and Silas on their, I believe it was their second missionary journey, is that right? But it was on one of their missionary journeys, and they come to Thessalonica. And as they come to Thessalonica, they are 3 weeks in the synagogue preaching. And it says they reasoned from the scriptures. And so they were teaching and reasoning and showing from the scriptures about Jesus being the Christ and that He was raised from the dead. They preached the resurrection from the dead. Now notice in this passage, someone read for us verses 4 through 6. Chuck, will you read for me? Acts 17, 4 through 6.
Yes. Verse 4. And some of them were persuaded, and the great multitude of the devout Greeks, and not a few of the leading women, joined Paul and Silas. But the Jews who were not persuaded became envious and took some of the evil men from the marketplace, and gathering a mob, set all the city in an uproar and attacked the house of Jason, and sought to bring them out to the people. But when they did not find them, they dragged Jason and some of the brethren to the rulers of the city, crying out, "These who have turned the world upside down have come here also."
Okay. And so, there at Thessalonica, they preached the gospel, and some joined themselves to Paul. There was success there, we would say, because we know from later, well, he wrote 2 letters to the church at Thessalonica. And so from things that are later said, there was good success at Thessalonica, we would say. And a good church grew up there. He was very warm in his statements about the church at Thessalonica later. But some refused. Some rejected. Some did not listen. And they even started a riot, didn't they? And they said, "Those who have turned the world upside down are come hither also." So wouldn't it be nice, wouldn't it be wonderful if someone said of us, "These people are turning the world upside down"? That's what we need to be doing. We need to be turning the world upside down. Now, what did they mean, turning the world upside down? What do you think they meant when they said, "These people are turning the world upside down"? They're bringing change. They're bringing a message which doesn't fit with our culture. This message doesn't fit with, and it's upsetting people. It's changing people. And I doubt, I'm sure Paul was making an impact. I doubt that it was making such an impact that it was about to overthrow the society in which they were living. But they said these things for the purpose of bringing accusation against Paul. But wouldn't it be nice if someone said that about us? That these people are turning the world upside down. So in truth, you are influencing. We are influencers. In one way or the other, we are influencers. Your influence will either be positive or negative. Your influence will be something. We sometimes think, or we sometimes say, "Well, I don't influence anyone." We don't see ourselves as influencers. But do we all have influence in some way, in some fashion, in some form? Sure we do. On our family, on friends, neighbors, people see our lives. They see who we are. They see how we act. It may just be the fact that we get up every Sunday morning and go to services, and they see that. Does that make an impact on people? Probably much more than we think. Other people are sleeping in. Other people aren't going to church. Maybe some of them are going to church too. But the point is, people see that. I've probably told you many times because I tell my illustrations over and over again, but we had friends many years ago and they got up and went to church every Sunday, and some of the people in the neighborhood started calling them the religies. The religies. Because they were so religious. They were the religies. Well, they had an influence, didn't they? People were seeing it. They may not have liked it. They were making fun of it. But they saw it. And so you're going to have an impact on others. So we are all influencers. The question is it for good or bad? what do they see of us? They see us getting up and going to services? Do they see us the way we interact with other people at work or in the marketplace? Do they have a positive? Do they have a positive? Do we have a positive impact on them? Do we show that we love people, or do they see us fussing with our wife in public and being angry with each other? What are they seeing? What are they seeing by the lives that we live? And so in this lesson, the author uses the story of Nehemiah for us to learn lessons about zeal and influencing and having an impact. Just to remind us of the chronology and where Nehemiah fits, if you have forgotten, this is not a portion, for some reason, this is not a portion of the Old Testament history. Maybe I shouldn't speak for you, but speak only for myself, that we don't study as much maybe as we do some of the other portions, and it's easy for me to forget the exact sequence of events. But here is the sequence as we go back to the return. After the captivity, of course, Israel and Judah, the northern and the southern nations, were both taken away into captivity. First, the northern tribes by the Assyrians. The Babylonians came to power and conquered all the land of the Assyrians. Now they were the big boy on the block. And they came and they conquered Judah in the south and took them away into captivity. So we know a lot about the period of the captivity. People like Daniel, people like Ezekiel, who prophesied during the captivity. In 536, after 70 years, if we count from 606, 606 was the first captives that were taken away into captivity under Nebuchadnezzar. Jeremiah had told them how long the captivity was going to last. Jeremiah told them, how long was it? 70 years. 70 years they were going to be taken away. From 606 minus 70 is what? 536. And so in 536, Cyrus, the king of the Persians, allowed them to return. And so the first of the Jews returned from Babylon in 536. I should say from Persia, because by that point, Persia had conquered the Babylonians. And so mark that out in your mind. Just write out Babylon in your mind and put in Persia there. Mistake by the teacher. The first Jews returned. But we think of the Babylonian captivity, so that still fits. In 535, after they returned, they began to lay the foundation of the temple. They laid the foundation of the temple. The temple's foundation was finished. But then they got lazy. We see later that Haggai and Zechariah, the prophets, were called to encourage the people to finish building the temple because they got working. Haggai says they got to working on their own houses and building their own houses, and they forgot the work of the Lord and they didn't finish the temple. And he corrects them about that. And they were then motivated by the prophets and others to finish the temple. And it was finished 20 years after they started, 20 years after they started. And so 536, the temple was completed. Then we see in 479 the story of Esther. And she was a queen of the king of Persia. And then in 538, we see that Ezra returns. So we had seen a return earlier in those books. The first part of Ezra tells us about the other returns. But Ezra himself did not come until 458. Then in 444 is our lesson today. About 444 to 433, Nehemiah comes and they rebuild the walls. It didn't take them all the way down to 433. But in the time about 444 to 433 was what we call his first governorship. He was governor of Judea. He returned to Persia and then came back again in 428. We think, most scholars think, about 428 to 423. He was there for a second governorship. We see some things about that at the end of this book of Nehemiah. So that's the general time frame for the time of Nehemiah. So our author makes five. He didn't list them in number. He didn't number them, but I numbered them because I like numbers on things. 5 points in the lesson. The first one is commitment. Being determined to make a commitment, being determined to make a difference. Being determined to make a difference. And his point, I think, in this first point that he makes in the lesson, is that Nehemiah did not set out to tackle every problem that was faced by the Jews. Now, he would tackle a number of problems as we read through the book of Nehemiah. We see that he tackled a number of things. But the old expression, first things first, right? First things first. And the first thing was, he came into the city and he needed to get the walls built. That was his goal. That's what he was trying to do. That was his commitment. And he focused on that commitment. Now, as we said, we see later in the book, he faced some other challenges. There was challenges of the people who were charging their brothers and sisters usury, were charging interest, and he had to correct that and get that straightened out. And there was a problem with intermarriage, and he had to rebuke them about that. And there was a problem with them working on the Sabbath day, and he had to straighten that out. And so piece by piece later, he started tackling some other things. But in the beginning, he was focused like a laser focused on one job, and that is building the wall. So he was devoted to a specific problem, build the walls. I kind of like this quote, as long as we kind of understand maybe. Anyway, there was a quote in the book, "Don't ask what the world needs, ask what makes you come alive and go do it, because what the world needs is people who have come alive." There's a lot of truth to that. Of course, if taken to the absolute sense to say, don't ask what the world needs. Well, we do need to ask what the world needs. The world needs the gospel, so with a caveat there. But the idea of the quote, the idea, I think, what he's emphasizing is that we need to be fired up about something. We need to have zeal. And within the work of the Lord, if we think of this quote in the picture of the work of the Lord, and doing things that the Lord wants us to do, each one of us, we can't do everything. We can't necessarily do everything. Some will be a song leader, and some will be a Bible class teacher, and some will help with the maintenance. Some are not able to do song leading. Some are not able to preach and teach publicly. But there are many members but one body. And we can focus on, we have a new little toilet back here. If you want to go see it and take pictures of it this morning, it has been installed, and Harold and his son Mark put it in. The old toilet in here for the children was leaking badly and had to be repaired and replaced, and he replaced that. And I mention that because that's not something I can do. That's not something I can do. That's not a talent I have, but Harold has that talent, and I'm thankful he's got that talent. I don't have to try to put in a toilet. Someone else has a different talent. Someone else has a different ability. And we should, but whatever we can do. There was a brother in Memphis, Tennessee, when I was first started preaching, and he's one of the deacons. And it scared him to death to try to teach. He was not able to teach or preach. But he was a deacon, and he was a good deacon, because there was never a light bulb out in that building. At least it wasn't out for very long. It would get replaced. You didn't have to worry about the maintenance. Brother Malone got the maintenance done. And he got it done on time, and he got it done regularly, and the place was neat, and the place was clean, and all the lights worked, and the heat worked, and the air conditioning worked, and if something went out, he was on top of it like now. And every place I've been has not always been that way. We need people like that. He was zealous for that job. He had zeal for that job. It was what he could do in the kingdom. And it was seen and it was appreciated. And so, whatever you can do, do it and be zealous about it. He gave an illustration in the lesson book about a Scott Harrison who focused on water projects. And because of his focus, funded over 6,000 water projects over a period of time. It made me think of some others. You've probably heard of Tunnel to Towers Foundation. Frank Siller, who lost his brother Stephen on 9/11. His brother was not on the job that day. I think he was on the golf course that morning. Was off work. But as soon as he heard what happened, he grabbed his stuff and he ran toward the towers. And he died trying to save people. And ever since then, Frank Siller has been raising money for the families of people who have lost husbands or wives, whatever the case may be, firefighters, mainly first responders, and raising money to build mortgage-free homes for them. They built 135 just, he's zealous about that. And you may have heard of Folds of Honor, Major Dan Rooney. Folds of Honor has given over, he focuses not on homes, but on scholarships for the families of service members who have been lost or disabled to where they cannot work. Over 20,000 scholarships, either private school elementary scholarships or university high school, college scholarships to the spouses or to the children of, he's laser focused on that. That's all he does 24/7, 365 is raise money for scholarships. That's what his focus is. And these are just examples of how people who are laser focused can get something done. That should be an example to us. Nehemiah had a passion, didn't he? He had a passion. And that passion was to rebuild the walls. He was fueled by his love for God, by his love for the people of God, for the situation that he heard about. Again, we haven't talked about the whole book in detail, but he heard when he was in Susa, when he was in Persia serving the king, he was a cupbearer to the king, and he heard from some of his brethren about the situation in Jerusalem. And how did he feel about it? He was very sad. And the king even noticed that he was so sad about it and asked him about it. And so that zeal fueled him. And so he focused on a specific problem. We would say it consumed him. And so we need to focus our attention on godly things, whether it be a problem or just the work generally or whatever it might be. And so we ask the question, what is something that we can focus on? What is there something that we can focus on as we either focus on the thing itself or focus on preparing ourselves to work on it in the future? Number two, communication. Nehemiah spoke with clarity. He said one of Nehemiah's greatest strengths was his ability to speak clearly. He took the time to investigate issues, form his thoughts, and speak directly to the needs of the moment. Look at chapter 2, Nehemiah chapter 2, and let's read 11 through 18. And so we said, Nehemiah was in the city of Susa. It says here in my version in chapter 1, verse 1, Shushan. But I think the more modern term is Susa. Any of your Bibles say Susa versus Shushan? 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 And footnote. And so, yours is in the text. I didn't pull up a map. I should have pulled up a map. But it's Persia, the edge of Persia. If you think in your mind, everybody knows where the Tigris and Euphrates rivers drain into the Persian Gulf. You're familiar with the Tigris and Euphrates Valley. If you're looking at that picture in your mind and you see the Tigris and Euphrates rivers running into the Persian Gulf, just to the east of that was Susa. It was not far from the Persian Gulf. It wasn't on the Persian Gulf. It was north of the Persian Gulf. But the ancient city was just to the east of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers in that part of the world. It was the capital of Persia at this time. And so, someone read for us. Who would like to read? Casey, would you read for me 11 through 18?
So I came to Jerusalem. There 3 days. Then I arose in the night, I and a few men with me. I told no one what my God had put in my heart to do. Nor was there any animal with me except the one on which I rode. And I went out by night through the valley. Then I went on to the fountain gate and to the king's pool, but there was no room for the animal under me to pass. So I went up in the night by the valley and viewed the wall. Then I turned back and entered by the valley gate and so returned. And the officials did not know where I had gone or what I had done. I had not told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, or the others who did the work. Then I said to them, "You see the distress that we are in, how Jerusalem lies waste, and its gates are burned with fire. Come and let us build the wall of Jerusalem, that we may no longer be a reproach." And I told them of that. I told them of the hand of my God, which had been good upon me, and also the king's words that he had spoken to me. So they said, "Let us rise up and build." Then they set their hands to do this good work.
Okay. So he hears of the need in Jerusalem. He asks for the help of the king when the king notices his countenance being sad. The king grants him permission. He asks for funds to help in this work. That is granted. He makes the trip and he comes to Jerusalem. So what's the first thing he does? He gets up on a soapbox and he announces to everyone why he's there, right? No? What's the first thing he did, Chuck? Yeah, he wanted to see firsthand what the situation was. And even went out by night quietly to take a look, didn't he? And so, as our author said, he took the time to investigate issues, form his thoughts, and then speak directly to the needs of the moment. And so he investigated, he looked at what it was, and then he spoke to the people that Jerusalem lieth waste, the gates thereof are burned with fire. Come and let us build the wall of Jerusalem. Sometimes all people need. Who did the work here? Did Nehemiah build the whole wall himself? No. Who built the wall? It was a team effort, wasn't it? If we see in chapter 3, you start noticing in chapter 3, it gives us a long detail of who built what section of the wall. And so everybody was working on the wall. Why hadn't they done this already? They had the manpower to do it. They did it. They did it here in chapter 3 and 4 and 5. We see they did it. Why hadn't they done it before? Lack of leadership. They didn't have a leader. People sometimes have abilities to do something if there is just leadership to encourage him to do it and to say, "I'm going to do this. We're going to do this. We need to build it. God wants us to do this." Chuck?
It's interesting as you're teaching this, if you go back to chapter 1 before he even does this, and it is the people that did it, but he's praying for servants who desire to fear your name. So it's not just any people, but people who have the dedication.
Yes. Excellent. Excellent point. He prays that there will be people who will people who want to serve God. People who want to serve God. And that's a very important point. So the people were there. They just needed to be rounded up and encouraged. And when they saw his faith and his zeal, then it got them fired up to do what they could do. And each one does a little part and it gets done, right? Okay, any other thoughts on that before we move ahead? Ron? Yeah.
But the people did.
Yes. Yes. Sometimes we can rally the people to do things that some of the others. There were nobles. There were, quote, leaders in the area, but they weren't the kind of leaders God wanted. They weren't the kind of leaders the people needed. Okay, point number 3 is cooperation. Involve the right people. And we kind of touched on that, and Chuck made an excellent point going back to chapter 1 about, you know, his prayer for the people, the right people, people who would be focused on God. And so it says, the author says, the first construction decision Nehemiah made was to use the right people. For Nehemiah, talent and manpower were not enough to warrant inclusion. Talented people with the wrong attitude and wrong motivation will not be true assets to a project. Look at chapter 2, verse 20. Now notice that in verse 19, we had Casey stop reading in verse 18, but in verse 19, we see the first mention in this book of dum, da dum, dum. The enemy, right? Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem. And when they heard of it, they laughed us to scorn and despised us. What is the thing that you are doing? Will you rebel against the king? Was Nehemiah rebelling against the king? He had permission from the king. He had permission from the king. Are people going to twist things and try to make them appear to be things that aren't? Yeah, all the time. And so they try to laugh him to scorn. What does Nehemiah say in verse 20? You don't have any part in this. You don't have any portion or right or memorial in this. What do your versions say for those three words? Mine says portion nor right nor memorial. Are yours in three words, Becky?
Mine says heritage, right, or memorial.
Heritage, right, or memorial. Any other words?
Claim.
Claim. Claim. No claim. You don't have no claim to this. What about that last word, memorial? Does everyone have a memorial? Ron?
Mine says, do you have no portion, right, or memorial in Jerusalem?
Okay, memorial again.
New English says ancient right.
Ancient right. Okay. I think they're all kind of tied together, but the idea is, this is not your work, isn't it? This is not your work. This is our work. You can laugh and you can make fun. And Chuck's point, again, ties very well. He had prayed to have people who were focused on God to help him to do this, but these were not the right people. These were not the right people because this was not their work. They didn't belong there. They were foreigners. They were not Jews. At best, they were a mixed race. But they were. It gives their nationalities here. Sanballat the Horonite, that's probably the town he's from, most think. Tobiah was an Ammonite, you remember the Ammonites, and Geshem was an Arabian, but they were not Jews. At best, as we said, maybe some had intermarried with the Jews. But this is not their work, this is God's people's work. Okay, talent alone is not enough, is the point. These men may have been very talented, but they had no right to the work. And if we take that point, we all, I think, understand that history is full of talented people who have failed. Have you ever known anybody that was talented? I don't mean famous. But have you ever known someone that was really smart, but never made, my daddy would say, never made a hill of beans, never worth anything? Very talented, had great talents, great skills, but they never amounted to anything. Why do talented people fail? Well, some talented people fail because of lack of hard work. We've known of kids that were brilliant, brilliant kids, very smart. But they were full of themselves. They wouldn't work hard. Elementary school was so easy, it just came to them, and they got in this. I guess they weren't motivated properly, but they got into this, got to being lazy. And never learned how to work hard. And then when they got to upper level school, when they needed to work hard, they didn't know how. They didn't have the gumption to work hard. And they were brilliant, but they failed. Ron?
And also the lack of common sense.
Yeah, lack of common sense. That's not on my list, but that's a good one. Impatient with a lack of... Some people get impatient if they don't succeed immediately. We talk about a generation of young people who, want to come out of college and immediately be making what their fathers and mothers made, after 40 years of work. They want the house immediately. They want the big car immediately, and they're impatient if they don't have it. Some are overconfident in their ability. Some are just arrogant and not willing to be coached and listen to others. There's a lot of reasons that talented people fail. I've known of young preachers who were full of talent but also full of themselves. And knew of their talent. Everybody was bragging on them, and that can be bad for a young preacher when you brag on them too much. I never had that problem. But some people, they brag on them and brag on them, make them get full of themselves, and they just, that's not good for a person. Brains, talent, natural abilities are good, but what's more important? Zeal. Zeal. Give me a zealous person any day. I'd rather have a zealous person that was his average intelligence than a person who is brilliant and had 150 IQ or something, but didn't have the other character. Now you combine the two together, man. You see these guys that write all these books, they are brilliant, they're intelligent, they're full of zeal for the Lord, and they've got ability plus the zeal, and what do? I mean, you see the mountain of materials maybe they produce. Now you combine the two together, and that's something that some of us can't do. But we need to have the zeal. Peter, what did you want to say? Yes.
Right things to do.
Yes.
And no matter how difficult it is,
Yeah, the attitude and the zeal, but the zeal's got to be focused in the right place, right? And so the attitude, the zeal, but focused on the Lord. And so we need people who are dedicated to Christ, supportive of leadership, zealous for the work of the Lord. A small handful of zealous people can accomplish great things, can't they? Who are full of zeal and full of faith. Think of Gideon and the 300. A small number, but with faith in God and zealous willingness to listen and do what God wants, can accomplish great things. And so page 75, he says, these people will show initiative to succeed, coordinate their efforts, contribute to areas they care about, zealously go the distance. And so these are all important things. Number four, conflict resolution. Rise above the interruptions. Rise above the interruptions. Projects worth pursuing always encounter challenges that threaten their progress. There's always going to be challenges. There's always going to be problems that arise. Nothing ever goes perfectly smoothly, does it? Ron.
They had the will to work.
And we didn't mention that specifically, but that was their attitude. That was their zeal. They had a mind to work, didn't they? That's what the scripture says. But there's always going to be challenges. No work of the Lord. As we think about the work of the Lord and our zeal for the Lord, there's no congregation that doesn't have challenges. Why is that?
People are people.
We're people. We're not gods. We're not perfect. We're striving towards perfection. We're striving towards maturity. But there's always going to be challenges. There's always going to be differences of opinions. There's always going to be some who are immature. As we convert people to the Lord, there's going to be young Christians who don't understand a lot of things. And sometimes they'll be a little impetuous. And sometimes they will say things that we're not used to hearing. And so there's always going to be the possibility of challenges. So how and whether or not we encounter and solve these problems will determine whether or not our project succeeds. We can't just sweep the problems under the rug and ignore them, can you? At home you can't do that, can you? Well, you can, but you're not going to have a peaceful home life. If you and your wife disagree about things, if you just ignore those things, they're not going to go away. There's going to be feelings with one or both of you about certain things. There are irritants, and they're not just going to go away if you try to sweep them under the rug. We need to address things in the proper way, in the right way, in a mature way, but things needs to be handled. Problems cannot be ignored. We cannot give in to the loudest and noisiest voices. Sometimes there are loud voices. You know what I mean? In situations, congregational situations, there are those who are more outspoken with their opinions about things. And in a situation where there aren't elders, that can especially sometimes become problematic. But in situations where there are elders, or even in not, we need to be able to take people aside and to work with people and to encourage people and to listen to people and to hear their complaints or their concerns. But also they need to learn that just because they're upset about something doesn't mean everyone else agrees with them. And so there needs to be a give and take. There needs to be an understanding. There needs to be an appreciation of the thoughts of others and a love and care about others as well. And so the loudest and noisiest voices can't necessarily get their way just because they think that if they scream loud enough or talk loud enough, then everybody will give in. I mean, people sometimes do that in the home. Why do people get angry? Why do people get angry and scream and yell in the home? Ever wonder about that? Someone says, well, they just lose their temper. But why do they do it?
They don't get their own way.
They don't get their own way. And they think if they scream and intimidate people enough, a husband who screams at his wife, and the wife thinks he's going to smack her if she doesn't do what he says, he may get his way temporarily, but is that going to produce a happy home? No, it's not. And so that's not the solution to peace. That's not the solution to a long-standing, happy home life, is it? Okay. And so I think we understand these things. Problems, sometimes we have problems from within. Every family, church, or team eventually faces problems from within their own membership. Look at Nehemiah chapter 5. And we don't have time. We're already out of time. Look at that. But Nehemiah chapter 5 is the passage that I referenced about a usury or interest. And some of the rich were charging interest to the poor, and they were struggling to the point of having to sell themselves into slavery or their sons and daughters because of the fact that they were being taken advantage of, and the law had taught against that, and he had to solve the problem. And he solved the problem by, you know, hitting it straight on, but also going to the scriptures, going to God. You know, God told you not to do this. It wasn't the authority of Nehemiah, it was the authority of God and what God had written in the law about it. And so he responded to the problem. How we respond to problems is critical to solving them with a positive outcome. Anger, frustration, bitter words can only bring hurt. Principles, truth must be upheld. He pointed to the truth. He pointed to what God said in the law. Love must be demonstrated, and patience must be shown. Ron?
And he is also a good example, because he would not do it either.
Very good. Very good. So later in that same chapter, it talks about the fact that from the time he became the governor, he was not greedy, wasn't he? Was he?
And he used some of his own money.
Used some of his own money. He did not have the people support him. And he even supported others. He even fed others. And so he himself was an example. And as leaders, we need to be an example. We can't demand to others what we're not willing to do ourselves. And Becky's dad was a great, I know I mentioned Becky's dad and my dad a lot, I'm sorry. But Becky's dad was a great example of that. Even though he was one of the elders, when we have a work party, he'd be out there working with the young people. We had this terraced area with an upper parking lot and a lower parking lot, and you know, you came around the circle and went up the hill to the upper level, but in between there was this ivy. I hated that ivy because weeds would grow in it, and we'd have to pull the weeds out of the ivy constantly. But when we have a work party, Walt would be out there pulling weeds with the rest of us to get the weeds out of the ivy, right? And so he wasn't above getting sweaty, even though he was one of the elders. He set the example. He showed the pattern. Problems from without. Satan will attack from without. Clearly in this story, you'll remember that Nehemiah was attacked from without. The Jews, the enemies of the Jews, tried to attack. We don't have time for all this. They mocked and they threatened and they joined themselves together. But and they tried even just to distract him and said, come down here and let's talk in the plains of Ono. And he says, I'm doing a great work. I can't come down and talk. We can't stop the work. They were, of course, had ulterior motives. And five, community addressed the project and the people. The wall was built in just 52 days. Nehemiah did not stop. He continued to address other things. And we talked about this earlier. There were a number of things that needed to be addressed. But the first thing was build the walls. Protect the people from the enemies without. Then he started working on the interior stuff. You build your walls first. You get your ceiling on. You get your roof on. You protect your family. You protect the house. And then you work on plastering the walls on the inside. Get first things first. He got the walls up first, and then he started working on other problems, like working on the Sabbath day and the mixed marriages and these other things that needed addressing. And so he tackled them both. We got to quit. It's 20 after. No one rang the bell, but our bell ringer is in Atlanta. Thank you all for your comments. Appreciate it. We will take a break.